Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, Red Sneaker Writers. This is episode 52, going out on August 24, 2020. My interview this time is with the renowned Christopher Vogler, keynote speaker at this year's WriterCon, and of course, known to writers everywhere as the author of the seminal work on writing, The Writer's Journey. Speaking of WriterCon, this will be my last chance to try and strong-arm you into registering, because the next episode will be recorded at WriterCon. It will be too late. So let me remind you one more time that this is the one writers' conference in 2020 that will not be canceled, has not been canceled, and this may be just what you need to boost your writing career to the next level. Trust me, we have got sessions scheduled on every aspect of writing, marketing, production, publication. There's something there for everyone. And let me also remind you, as you may have heard on previous podcasts, that there are a lot of different ways to attend this year. You can attend in person in Oklahoma City, Labor Day weekend, September 4th through 6th, or you can stream it from home. I understand some people are reluctant to travel right now, and that's just fine. You can stay at home and stream every single session, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, more than 60. Or if you have a conflict on the days in question, all of those sessions will be recorded and put online, made available for 2 weeks after the conference. So you can come, you can stream it live, you can watch it afterwards, or you can do any combination of the above. So that's really four different ways you could participate in WriterCon. Please visit our website, writercon.org, and see if this might be something that could help you achieve your writing goals. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention that this week, on August 25th, my new novel, Judge and Jury, goes on sale. And, you know, this will be the fifth book in the Daniel Pike series. I mean, I might be prejudiced, but I think it's terrific, and I'm hoping you will too. So take a look at wherever you buy books and see if you want another copy of Judge and Jury. We'll talk about all that and more, but first, here's the news. The big news in the publishing world this time is that the major publishers have released their quarterly sales reports, and in the main, it's pretty much exactly what you would think it's going to be. All of the big five New York publishers are reporting sales declines, although in some cases, improved earnings. And you might wonder, well, how is that possible? I think that almost every time I look at sales reports from New York publishers. Take it all with a grain of salt, but here's what seems to be true across the board. Everybody's sales of print books are significantly down. I mean, what do you expect? Bookstores have been closed brick and mortar bookstores have been closed during the lockdown, so print is down, but almost all publishers are seeing increased profits due to increased sales of ebooks and audiobooks, where they have, of course, less overhead, less production cost. So for people positioned, like Red Sneaker Writers, to profit from ebooks or audiobooks, this has actually been a pretty good period, despite all that's going on in the world. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you'll recall we were worried during the first month or so of lockdown. Book sales seemed to almost evaporate entirely. But what seems to have happened is that in later days, people who like to read but couldn't go to the library, couldn't get into the bookstores, discovered ebooks. Even those who might have been reluctant to read ebooks in the past when they had little choice turned to ebooks. So those sales increased. And of course, audiobooks have been on a tear for many years. The ease of downloading digital audiobooks without any need for medium, no cassette tapes, no CDs, just download it and have it on your phone in 10 seconds or so has really made those sales skyrocket. I'll just say again, Red Sneaker Writers, if you don't have everything you've got in ebook form or an audiobook form, you need to start doing that now. Here's some of the more interesting things that came out of these sales reports. A lot of people reporting for digital reporting more digital revenue, even, and this could be a real sign of the times, the oldest bastion of old school journalism, the New York Times, announced that for the first time, their digital revenue exceeded that of their print revenue. In other words, they're making more from people subscribing to read the newspaper online than actual print versions. That's not the only information in digital sales. Libraries are also reporting that they're investing more heavily in digital sales, particularly ebooks, but also audiobooks. People who are like Overdrive, which anybody, even a self-publisher or independent publisher, can have an account with, somebody distributing digital books to libraries are seeing sharp increases. That too seems to be a sign of the time. Print sales are becoming more problematic, and not just because of the COVID lockdown. We've talked before about how some of the major printers are going out of business. This has made it a difficult time for people dependent upon print sales. On the first hand, there's great uncertainty. How many books should we have printed during the lockdown when we don't even know what bookstores are going to be open in the future? Couple that with, I mean, they're never sure how many books to print, but they usually can take a low-key guess. But now, couple uncertainty with difficulty finding printers to print books. People who are dependent upon offset printing have found it very hard to find printers, made it a difficult time. More and more people are relying on Ingram or other publishing, other printers that have print-on-demand services, if not as their first go-to for printing, then as their backup. And let me also remind you, Red Sneaker Writers, that anybody can have an account with Ingram. There's a fee, of course, but any self-publisher or independent publisher can set up their book in Ingram and then just have the books printed as people want them, as people order them, rather than having to have a huge number printed up front at some offset publishing house. Here's another thing that it's clear that the major publishers are doing right now, watching the Amazon 100. Even if they may dislike Amazon and consider themselves their major competition, that has been the go-to place, that has become the go-to place to find out what's selling right now, which of course is always of interest to writers like Red Sneaker Writers. Even if you're not writing to the market, there's often a right time for a certain book. Write the book that's in your heart, but at the right time. The time when you break into the market and make your mark is when you have the right book in the right place at the right time. And everybody's watching the Amazon 100 to find out what's selling like now, not 6 months ago, because often sales reports like these show what sold in the past. This is a way to find out in real time what's selling right now, what's selling this week at Amazon, the biggest bookseller in the United States, where more than 50% of all books and something more like 70% of all ebooks are sold. What's selling this week may give you an indication of what you ought to be writing. I'll conclude with a great story from Descript, the service I've talked about before that helps people to produce podcasts like this, increasingly popular, and audiobook. They've now got an AI feature, an artificial intelligence voice command feature for their pro-level subscribers. Descript lets you edit your audio work, whether it's audiobooks or podcasts, by looking at the words, the script, and then you can edit or type, and it changes the audio files accordingly. But with this new feature, you can train the program to learn your voice, just like your Siri or something. Of course, you have to say a lot, but it learns. You program the vocabulary. And then if you want to edit, say, your podcast to correct a mistake, not that I would ever make a mistake, but if somebody else did, or if I wanted to add something that I forgot to say, it can put the words in an AI version of your voice. You don't believe this? Go over to Joanna Penn's website. She's recorded an entire conversation between her and somebody else. It's all AI. They wrote it. The voice created it in this AI program. And let me tell you, if you didn't know, you wouldn't know. You might, if you know, be able to say, oh, that's not quite the right inflection or what's, but, you know, for spot editing, we may be seeing a whole new world. We're already in a world where anybody, including you, can produce your own audiobooks. At some point in the future, you may be able to do it without even talking. If this podcast sounds a little different, there's a reason. I'm recording this one live from the Central Region Oklahoma Writers Retreat. And no, that wasn't AI applause. That was actual, no laugh traps. That was actual real people who are here at this wonderful retreat we're having in Guthrie, Oklahoma. We've had a great day out here. And for the writing tips section this time, I thought we'd talk to some of the people here, including the host, the person who put this whole thing together, Allie Robertson. Allie is the head of this organization and also an author of more than 20 books. I'm seeing some people looking skeptical because I said she was the head of the organization. What, is that not right?
No, I'm not. I'm just a control freak.
Well, okay. You put together this event.
Yes.
She's the author of more than 20 books. Plus, she is a major editor. Just stop me before I do this. At Wild Rose Press, which is a major publishing house. Allie will also be a WriterCon, taking pitches and speaking. And I asked her to think about what are the recurring mistakes or errors or problems that you see in work that's submitted to this. I mean, this press publishes more than 60 books a month, right? This is a major operation. So you get all kinds of submissions. What are the problems you see happening over and over again?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me and thank you for being here at our retreat. We've learned so much from you today and I appreciate it so much. As an editor, I receive, you know, multiple submissions. And one of the things that I see frequently, especially from newer writers, is the author will try to explain everything up front about the character, why they're in the situation they're in, what their background is, what kind of childhood they had, how they feel, you know, and all that. And they feel like they need to explain everything or the reader won't know, you know, why they're who they are or where they are. But it's always best to start with action, even if it's not an action book. It doesn't have to be a suspense or whatever, but if you need to show your main character doing something when you open the story.
You don't need the whole backstory in the
exactly.
first paragraph.
Exactly. They need to learn. It's like when you meet someone in person. They don't sit down and just tell you everything about themselves, hopefully. But you, as you get to know them, you learn more about them. And you need to wait until a situation arises in your book where the readers, you know, are asking a question or learning about the character. Show the character in action. Don't, as an author, tell your reader everything about your character.
That seems like very good advice. What else you got in there?
Well, we have a lot of submissions with filter words, which is a pet peeve of mine.
What do you mean by filter words?
Filter words are words that distance the reader from the story, from the character. If you say she felt a pain pierce her heart, or she could see the, you know, pain in his eyes. I don't know why I keep focusing on pain. But
it's because you've been here all day.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, instead of saying she felt or he could see or he could tell, just show that emotion. You know, pain filled his eyes. Pain pierced her heart. Give me some happy words. Joy.
Happiness.
Joy filled her heart. Not love. She felt... Yes, she felt love for him. You know, you don't need to say felt, heard, saw, thought. A lot of times they'll state a character's thought. This was going to be a great day, she thought. Well, if we're in her head and you state the sentence, we know that she thought it because we're in her head.
If you've established the viewpoint, it should be obvious.
Viewpoint, correct. And which viewpoint's another very important thing is to establish a viewpoint and stick with it in one scene. Do not, I see a lot of head hopping, which is when you go from, you're in one scene, but you go from one character's thoughts or, you know, their mind, and then you pop into another character's head. That's right. Jarring for the readers, and they don't know who to connect with. So
right. They may not even be aware that you're head hopping.
Right.
But the reader's feeling is, I'm losing it. This isn't drawing me in.
Right, exactly. They want to connect deeply with the main POV character, and you want to keep them in that character's.
Excellent advice. Anything else? One more?
Not that I can think of, right offhand.
For pushing my
exactly.
Luck.
I did my best.
Thanks, Allie. We're going to have another person speak now, Mary Jo Springer. She's the author of at least 4 books, the most recent one being For the Sheik's Pleasure. Mary Jo, you got a tip for us?
Yes, I came here today looking for factors to create inner conflict in my characters. Mm-hmm. And I found out that you should dive into your characters' insecurities, search for what's fueling their desperation to reach those goals, and challenge their honor and their integrity.
Mm-hmm. And how? How do you do that? How do you make that happen?
I think you have to really understand what's motivating your character on a real deep level, and then try to bring that out.
Which doesn't mean dumping a lot of backstory, but bringing it out in what the character does.
Right, and kind of feathering that backstory just a little bit through the story.
That's great. Great advice. Okay, one more. Debbie Rogers, also with us here today at the retreat. Debbie, give us your writing tip.
Yes, sir. Okay. Well, I'm excited that I got to be here today because I didn't know if I would or not, so I just wanted you to know how much I appreciated it.
Well, glad you could make it.
I have one book published, that's all. So I'm working on my second book, and I came here looking for help with dialogue, specifically male point of view. But one of the things that I came away with was different information that was very interesting. And when I was looking through, actually, I got some of Bill's books.
Okay. Always a great idea.
Yes, it is. It was. And I have a few of these books at home. I just didn't know which ones. And so I was looking through these books, and it occurred to me that when I taught English in high school, we talked an awful lot about adverbs, and
right.
I actually learned more once I started writing, you know, after I retired and now I'm writing stories. I finally figured out, and it was looking at one of your books, Bill, in one section, it said, you know, that watch out for these adverbs, or exactly, I can't remember what he said, what it was, but I understand it now because you throw in an adverb, and you look at what the adverb is modifying, and it's basically restating the word. And so that has helped. That's helping my writing a lot, and I appreciate that.
If you've chosen the right verb, you shouldn't need the adverb.
Right, exactly. Right? Oh, yes. And picking those strong verbs, absolutely. And leaving out the he said, she said, you know, he but said grimly, you've got to understand that he just said something that was very grim. But my other favorite thing is, if I were giving any kind of a tip, it would be from reading all the books that are, I have so many ebooks, and they're, you know, mostly, mostly newer books, and that is coming up with fresh metaphors. And they are just, things have just been blowing me away reading the metaphors of these, some of these new, or I don't know, that new, but new favorite authors for me. And not that I want to, if I want to mention a couple of metaphors, can I say who the author was? And
yes.
Then I'm okay?
Give us one. Give us a good one.
Just give you a good one. Okay, this one is a J.T. Geisinger. And she's the point of view character, you know, we're in her head, and she's just looking into the eyes of this guy that she's, now they both know that they're madly in love, right? And she says, what she sees is entire cities are burning to the ground behind his eyes. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, loved it. So, anyway, metaphors and adverbs.
Great. Thanks, Debbie. Great writing tips. My interview this time is with the acclaimed Christopher Vogler, keynote speaker at this year's WriterCon, and he's been somebody I've been trying to get for a long time. I actually met him many years ago when I was the president of Novelists, Inc. He was our keynote speaker there, and I had the pleasure of introducing him and meeting him, and I've pretty much been trying to get him to my conference ever since, and finally, it's happening, so I'm not letting any lockdown spoil that. He will be presenting at WriterCon this year. As you may already know, Vogler has been involved not only in books, but in the film industry. In fact, he was working at Disney when he was first exposed to the work of Joseph Campbell, The Hero's Journey, these mythological constants that Campbell found in storytelling throughout the ages, and started applying that to the work they were doing there. Wrote a memo that swept virally all throughout the Disney Corporation, and he ended up working on The Lion King, Aladdin, and a lot of other wonderful films. His best-known book is The Writer's Journey, and just to tell you how influential that book is, it's just been released in a special 25th anniversary edition. Here's what Christopher had to say. Chris, thanks for being on the podcast.
Now, this is a great pleasure. Glad to be with you.
I have a traditional first question about the first question that I ask people, which I did not warn you about at all. So here I'm springing it on you. If you could give an aspiring writer one piece of advice, what would that be?
I would say just do your thing every day and make it part of your normal deal. And I believe in this thing from The Artist's Way, which is a great book by Julia Cameron. She talks about morning pages, and it's just a way of warming yourself up every day so that it becomes almost muscle memory. And so if you're starting out, writing might be an intermittent thing for you that you do every once in a while, but it's really got to become part of a daily hygiene almost of getting stuff off your chest and training your hands and fingers and eyes to do that so that it becomes, oh, what's wrong? I haven't written today. Ah, I've got to, yeah, make that agreement with yourself.
Yeah. Oh, man up for my own heart. That's exactly what I would have said myself. Chris, you are our keynote speaker this year at WriterCon. People have been telling me, and for that matter, even before everybody kept telling me, get Christopher Vogler, I remembered when I was president of Novelists, Inc., and you were our keynote there, and people still talk about what a powerful experience it is hearing you speak. And of course, everybody loves The Writer's Journey. When was that first published?
It's we're calling it the 25th anniversary edition. That's a little bit of a fudge. It was actually about 27 years ago. So back somewhere around 1996 or so, It's been in the works all that time, and goes back at least 25 to 27 years.
Well, 25th anniversary sounds cool. Is there new material in this edition?
Yes, I tried to freshen it up a little bit. First of all, there was a lot of little editorial things, like I recommended that people watch movies on VCRs and you know, things like that, that kind of have a hollow ring these days. So we rid the book of most of that. But I stuck my neck out into new territory. Over the last few years, I've been working with ideas around something called the chakra system, which comes from Eastern philosophy. Mm-hmm. And simply put, they imagine there are different spiritual centers up and down the spine, and they control different things like the heart and the throat and the power center down around the navel and the sex and elimination centers lower in the body. And I thought about this because when I was working for the studio system and I had to comment on scripts and really try to sell people on the idea, you should read this script, this is a good story, good possibility for us, I found I was pointing to these different centers and saying, it got me here and here. And I'd point in a good script to maybe two different centers, that it got me in the throat, choked me up, but it also made my heart race, or it tightened me up in the guts, and then it lifted the top of my head off with some revelation at the end. I realized that there were circuits and that this is a good way to think about targeting these areas in the body, because I feel it's really communicating with an audience, and writing is really about touching the emotions, but through the organs of the body, and that we're really in the business of activating these different centers. And so you feel something when you read or watch a story.
Now, you've said that the original writer's journey take was inspired by the work of Joseph Campbell. Do you think these two systems, Campbell and chakra, blend together well?
Yes, they do, actually, because Campbell had a belief, I think, about the hero's journey that, okay, it's this interesting literary form, and it's very persistent, and it's very entertaining, but he saw it as an encoded set of instructions about how to achieve a higher level of consciousness, that there was a lot of hidden suggestion in there about the stages you go through as you're trying to achieve enlightenment. And the chakra system is related to this too, because theoretically you move upward through the chakras from the lower things, the animal things, to the higher and more spiritual levels as you go up towards the top of the head. And so there's quite a bit of overlap in those two systems.
Take us through the story, if you would, where this book came from. Once upon a time, at least 27 years ago, you were working at Disney, is that right?
Yes, I had found my way to Disney through a pathway, which basically was, as a kid, enjoying fairy tales that were read to me by my mother and grandmother, and also watching movies and going to the drive-in and seeing old movies on TV and so forth, I was fascinated by the similarities and the patterns that I saw, and also just really blown away and quite physically affected by the wonderful stories. And I wanted to know, how do they know how to make this thing so exciting? And if they're taking a historical character or adapting something from Charles Dickens, let's say, how do they know what to put in and what to leave out, and you know, how to change things and how to emphasize? All these questions were in my mind. So I was on a quest looking for the book. Where's the guidebook? Where's the rule book for this? And I couldn't find anything in film school. It was all seat of the pants. And we didn't have any screenwriting books at that time, if you can imagine that, when the world is now flooded with them.
Right.
But I was looking for the unwritten rules, and I found them in the work of this man, Joseph Campbell. Fortunately, some film professor heard me mention an interest in mythological themes, and I thought I saw mythological things in some movies we were viewing. And he said, if you're interested in that, you should go to the library and get that book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Campbell. And I flipped through it on the bus on the way home. And by the time I got off the bus, my life was changed because this is what I was looking for. This was the kind of secret guidebook that told the skeletal structure that really defines what a story is to us. And then all the different cultures have made their variations on it. But it's something I feel very deeply ingrained in human beings. It's part of the brain. We evolved, I think, a level of the brain that processes the world in terms of stories. And there's a lot of scientific evidence of that coming in now. So that's the quest tale that I tell, that I was on that search. And then it helped me so much when I started working for the studios, and I was tasked to read a lot of scripts and write reports on them. And I'm so grateful that I had Campbell's outline as sort of a guidepost for this, because it made that job a lot easier.
The first time I ever heard George Lucas talk about Star Wars being inspired by Joseph Campbell, I thought, oh, stop already. Yeah. You don't have to be the professor. You wrote a great outer space movie. And now every time I see it, it's so obvious to me, all of the hero's journey paradigms and ideas, they're right there.
They certainly are. And I was, I guess, lucky in that I had just absorbed Campbell's book when that first Star Wars movie came out. And Lucas himself had gone to the same film school, the USC Cinema School. And he had been there 10 years before I got there. So he was way ahead of me. But he very generously invited the whole school and the faculty to come and see this new movie, Star Wars. And we were worried about it because we thought he'd lost his mind, because nobody was doing movies like that. At the time, this was the era of a
serious director, right?
Yeah. See, he had done American Graffiti, which is a great exploration of pop culture nostalgia and so forth. And he was giving indications he was going to go a different way. And then suddenly we read in the trades, he's doing this old time Flash Gordon movie serial about some Princess Leia Organa of the universe. And we just thought he'd lost his mind. So we went and saw it. And everybody reacted, realizing, oh, our whole careers are going to be different now. The possibilities are blown open. You can do anything with this new medium of special effects. But I saw it with a different view because I had just read Campbell. And I'm just going, by the time they got to the cantina, I said, he's definitely read Campbell's book. And he's just ticking the boxes on all these points. And he's found a way to make it commercial. And I thought that was fantastic. That's very much the impulse I had, was it's great academic thinking, but it's also something very practical and can be used on modern stories as well as fantasies and historical stuff. So that was my realization about it.
Speaking of monster hits, you worked on The Lion King, am I right?
Yes, that was a kind of a high watermark for me of my time at Disney. I was there for a long time, over 10 years, but I had worked my way up from the routine job of reading scripts and writing reports to a little bit more almost in the executive category, where they gave me special assignments. I did a lot of research. If they needed to know about comic books, they'd tell me, just go out and buy every comic book printed this month and give us a report on what are the trends, what's coming down the line. So I had this kind of unique position in the company, but I wrote a memo because we communicated in memos within the studio framework. And so I wrote a memo explaining Campbell's ideas as a guideline for any kind of movie, modern or period piece or fantasy, whatever. It was kind of my attempt to lay out a universal code or algorithm is what we would call it today. And that memo went around and became viral within the studio and eventually ended up in front of the head of the company at that time, the head of production, Jeffrey Katzenberg. And he threw me in with the animation people. He said, this is a good match. And they're working on this picture right now that was called something different. It wasn't The Lion King. I think it was called King of the Jungle or something like that at that time. But it ended up being The Lion King. And I thought I would have a sales job to do. I thought I'd have to go in there and explain my whole theory. But when I walked in, that memo had already penetrated. And the first thing I saw in the lobby was a cork board with the drawings for The Lion King already pinned up to it. And they had outlined the whole thing by my 12-stage Hero's Journey deal. So they were already pre-sold and I didn't have to convince them. But they turned the whole thing over to me one afternoon. They got out the old furniture from Disney's day and I actually sat in Walt Disney's chair and looked at their presentation. And they asked me, what do you think? And so I gave them my thoughts. And some of that found its way into the movie. There are a few shots and scenes that are really there because I made these suggestions. And they'd already animated a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But they said, he's right. Everybody knew when I said some of these suggestions that it was right because all the animators started drawing pictures of these things as soon as I mentioned them. Just intuitively, they said, oh, that's good. I'll draw that. So they stopped production and retooled and put in some of these ideas. For example, in the opening scene, the famous Circle of Life, there's a baboon shaman. I think he's a baboon, Rafiki, mm-hmm. who picks up the lion cub and holds it up and shows everybody. And I said, wouldn't it be cool if at the climax of the music, a shaft of light comes out of the cloud. And they said, oh man, we've already animated this completely, but that's so good, we have to stop and put it in. So I scored a few points on that one. And that was a great treat to be involved that way.
What a wonderful thing to have an influence on this spectacularly successful film that then became a spectacular stage show and has been remade as a movie and about 1,400 other incarnations. That's going to be around forever.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm very pleased that one idea I threw out in that meeting ended up in the stage play being brilliantly realized. I said that the land has to be affected by the evil guy taking over, Scar, the bad lion. His rule would be so toxic that even the water holes would dry up. So the animators drew that. But in the stage play, they realized it very simply by simple stage magic. They just put a big piece of blue fabric on the, like parachute silk. They put that on the stage to represent the watering hole. And then they had drilled a hole in the middle of the stage under it. And somebody below the stage just pulled a string and the whole blue water hole, so to speak, got sucked down to nothing and disappeared. And just that simple thing, a piece of fabric and a hole in the stage created this magical effect. And I just love that. The simplest answers sometimes are the most magical.
Chris, I know a lot of people listening to this are writers or aspiring writers, and they're thinking, okay, this sounds wonderful. I want to enrich my work and produce the next Lion King or Star Wars. Where would you recommend that they start?
I think the starting place is best at the very beginning of your writing career to go to stuff, as they often say, as teachers rightly often say, and try to reach into something that you feel very passionate and strong about, because it's going to be a long march from wherever you're starting to finish something and get it to market, or just to finish it for your own satisfaction. And then move on to something else. It's a long march. So it better be something that you really feel passionate about. And my state now, and I think a lot of people get to this stage, is you have a lot of projects you want to do. And when time is cleared, you freak out. Like, which one should I do? And I always test them. Like, where is the most energy? Where am I most excited? And that's the one I'm going to give my energy to now, because that's the horse that wants to run. So let's be sensitive to those things and go where you're most excited.
Mm-hmm. And then when you're fleshing that out that idea out, I'm just going to throw out, get a copy of The Writer's Journey, preferably the cool new 25th anniversary version.
It couldn't hurt.
Yeah, and come to WriterCon and hear you speak there. That couldn't hurt either.
Yes, I'll be tossing out some old chestnuts, but some new things and things that are informed by my own writing career and my efforts to fan out a little bit from being a consultant and also be an author. I've written some things. I had an animated feature produced from a script I wrote in Europe, and I am in there pitching.
Fantastic. Chris, thank you for being on the podcast.
It's delightful. Thank you, William, and good luck with your conference coming up.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you again, Chris, for being on the podcast. Let me just remind you, it is not too late to sign up for WriterCon. Please go to the website and see if there might be something at this conference that you want to see either in person or streaming at home. The website, again, is writercon.org. That's WriterCon.org. And hey, while you're online, take a look at your favorite online bookseller and see if you might be interested in picking up a copy of Judge and Jury. This is the fifth Daniel Pike book. There's only going to be six, so you don't want to fall behind. Take a look at Judge and Jury. Remember, until next time, keep writing. You cannot fail if you refuse to quit.